Hello, and welcome to this podcast from Consider This. Please let me know what you think and tell others about us on social media. This podcast was originally broadcast live on Northumberland 89.7 FM. You can hear this show live every Friday at noon. Thank you for downloading this program, and I hope you enjoy it. Hello, I'm Robert Washburn, and welcome to Consider This Northumberland, a current affairs program dedicated to the issues facing our community. We talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life in Northumberland County. So I'm asking you, the listener, to take some time out of your busy day to consider this. Chad Valier is a peer support worker and recovery advocate working in Northumberland. He is the keynote speaker at the Come Together Northumberland event on Friday, May 8th, at the Coburg Community Center. Have a listen and see if he can alter the way you see these issues. I'm so pleased to have with me today Chad Valier, a peer support worker and recovery advocate.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How about you?
It's a pleasure to be here. I'm doing really great. Thank you.
You are described as a recovery advocate. What is that?
That means I try to be a voice for the voiceless. I got my peer support job through lived experience, which means I had to go through the ringer in order to get to where I am today. And so when I say I'm a recovery advocate, I try to take the stigma out of what it looks like to people from the outside to be, you know, to have a substance use disorder, or, as you know, I like to say, a drug addict. Some people don't like that terminology. I find it really easy to go to that word or that term for the simple fact that it just kind of reminds me of, you know, where I was at one point in my life, and it doesn't allow me to forget.
So how are you supporting those who struggle with or are in recovery from substance abuse or addiction?
Well, for one, if they reach out to me for help, I let them know very early on that, you know, for a long time, my time wasn't very valuable. Today it is. So if you really want help, I'm here to guide you in whatever direction you want to go. Now, I have learned through time that abstinence is not a recovery path for everybody. There are like other avenues you can take. Personally, I find abstinence works the best, but that doesn't mean that I'm anti anything else. You know, I believe, you know, I say this and it may come off harsh, but I don't believe dead addicts can recover. So harm reduction for me, what it looks like is, as long as you don't die in the process, it gives you another chance, right? So with some people, I don't, you know, and I'll give you an example. I knew a woman who, you know, was an opioid addict, and she had 6 children. You know, when you're coming off a drug like that, you know, it can take up to 14 days of withdrawal. Some people don't have such luxuries, you know what I mean, to take 14 days and take the time they need to recover. So that's where harm reduction, I think, works in people's favor, because she still has to function. She still had to raise kids. You know, she still had to work, and to lay on her couch or in her bed for 2 weeks, you know, that wasn't an option. Right. So, I mean, if there's a plan that follows a harm reduction method for me, I believe it works great. You know, for me, it was abstinence. I had to be completely abstinent.
You make it sound, though, like there's only 2 avenues, harm reduction or not doing it at all. Are there other paths that maybe the rest of us aren't aware of that are viable and valuable?
Well, for me, what I've learned is, you know, you can take many different. So like you can do a 12-step method, which worked for me. I love the 12 steps. You can take a spiritual road and really lock into faith, spirituality, church. There's things like smart recovery, where it's more of an evidence and science based road, you know, where they kind of meet you where you are. And again, with a lot of programs like smart recovery and things like that, abstinence is not a requirement, right? And so it's about meeting people where they are, which, you know, everybody's not ready to necessarily stop, you know, and that's okay too. You know, to me, you know, you'll stop when you're ready and not a moment before. Right. So these other avenues give you another chance until you figure out what road it is you want to take.
Do you address any form of addiction or just drug related addictions?
Oh, no. For me, I believe that addiction, it's just addiction, like anything that'll make your life unmanageable. And for me, that can be anything. Like, and I use me as an example because that's what I know best. Right. So for me, when it comes to addiction, it can be something, you know, if it's food, if it is, you know, binging on Netflix, if, you know, I can take drugs, alcohol, anything that makes me feel good or takes me out of self, I can destroy my life with it really fast.
How does one reduce the stigma surrounding people with addictions or are recovering from an addiction?
Well, I remember somebody saying to me one time, if the substance, whether it be drugs, food, sex, anything like that, if that was the issue, it would do the same thing to everybody, right? We have to understand that it goes deeper than the substances involved. And I think that is why when they speak of addiction, they use the terms addictions and mental health, because the two go very hand in hand. And you know, the one thing I've learned throughout time is people with substance use disorder, you know, regardless of their walk of life or whether they came from poverty or whether they come from, you know, riches, I find the thought patterns and the obsessions and the way they think and the way they act and the way they talk, it all lines up. And that's something that I think speaks, you know. So if, you know, I've never met you in my life, and then you start telling me about your problem or your issue, and I can completely relate to it, and I've never met you in my life, there's something to be said for that, right? So to think that it'll escape you because you come from a different walk of life or your sexuality or your ethnicity or anything like, that's crazy, because it'll get, it's like cancer. It'll get whoever it gets.
I appreciate how you've framed this as a sort of a universal experience or a universal framework that people live in. But I guess when I was saying stigma, I'm wondering, you know, how other people react around this. People who are not like you, who, you know, can see through and see the commonality, but rather see something and want to push it away. How do you address that aspect of the stigma?
Well, for me, the sad thing is, I find, is that a lot of people aren't willing to look past the stigma until it happens to someone they know or love. And then they realize how indiscriminatory it is. Right. So I know, for instance, for me, I'm a peer support worker. Right. I've been clean for May 31st will be 5 years. Right. 10 years before that, I was homeless. You know what I'm saying? So for you to look at somebody in that situation and just assume that that's just kind of where they're at or where what they chose. I mean, you really have to get a little more educated. And I think that is where we are failing, because we're not getting that information out there. You know, you're not like, I don't know anybody that ever just sat down and said, I want to destroy my life, right? I want to hurt the people I love. I want to, you know, I want to destroy families. I want to steal from people. I want to lie. I want to manipulate. Like, I don't think anybody sits down and does that. So once you realize that, you know, you are powerless and when you are in active addiction, then I think, you know, once people realize, once that's taken hold, that that person is not the person anymore.
So how do you educate the public then? Because that's a pretty big leap you're asking people to make.
Sure. And sadly, it's not something we can fix in a couple minutes, right? So what I do is I'm very loud about it. Like, I'm, you know, very successful today, right? And I have no qualms telling people that I have suffered from addiction. I have substance use disorders. I have things that led to that. So the louder I am about it, and when they see you can come out of it, and that, you know, the only rock bottom I believe you can't come back from is death, right? So as long as you don't die, there's a chance you could, like I said, you know, 10 years ago, I was homeless, right? And if I can go from homeless to being a published author, to having a documentary made about my story, to working with youth as a peer support worker, you know, the louder I can yell that from the mountaintops, the more apt people are to believe that it's possible and see that they're not just these people dying on the streets, that they are human beings and that they're just shells of themselves out there.
Do you work to change addiction laws?
I don't. And it's something I'd like to be more active in. Because here's the thing. I watched a really cool TED Talks and they talked about in Portugal where they decriminalized drugs, right? And for Portugal, it worked really well because there was a really great plan put behind it. The problem was Canada, like British Columbia, tried it and they had no plan in motion. They just went, well, it's legal, so just do it, right? And then they just allowed safe injection sites and people were just doing drugs. Whereas Portugal, instead of treating drug addicts like criminals, they treated them as though they were sick and they gave them opportunity. So, and you know, they would, you know, reintegrate them into society once they gave them a trade. You know, the government would pay for their wage for a year for a company to hire them to give these guys hope and possibilities, right? So it wasn't like they just said, do drugs and get better. They just said, like, you know, if we decriminalize this and treat them as though they're sick instead of like they're degenerates, then there's more apt, we're more apt to be able to help them. If we can teach these, like, when, you know, drug addicts don't come with a nest egg or good credit. So when you get clean, what are your options? And that's the scary part, because there's not a whole lot of motivation for people to get clean. Like, and this is where the problem is so big that the most we can do at this point is chip away at the small parts of it.
It's interesting you raise the case of the British Columbia government, because there's just been recent reports put out that more than 18,000 people have died since the toxic drug crisis was declared in April of 2016. And the efforts have drawn a lot of criticism, and especially around safe injection sites. So how do you respond to these numbers and these policies? You've given us a hint of it, but have these criticisms harmed or helped addicts in your opinion?
Well, I think, again, when you're surrounded by people who think you're a degenerate and there's nothing on the other side that you can see in the near distance, you know, it's not a lot of motivation. And, you know, when, you know, disability checks in Canada are only between $1,100 to $1,300, and people, you know, to get an apartment, a one bedroom, you're looking at $2,000. And that's for a cheap one, unless you want to get one for 17 or 18 and live with bed bugs and rats, right? Where is your motivation to get well? And you're right, like the numbers just keep getting better, or getting higher. Better. What a bad way to say it, but the numbers are getting higher because there's nothing being done. And I wish there was this one size fits all fix to the problem, but we have to break it down bit by bit. And the best we can do now, I think, is bring awareness. And with awareness, we'll come action, hopefully.
Do you work to connect individuals with resources? Is that something you do in your work?
I do. It's one of many, many hats I wear at my job. And I, you know, but I do a lot of service outside my job. Like when I'm not at work, I am out there, you know, I'm going to detox. I'm going to hospitals. I'm going to anywhere that will allow me to share my story of hope so that I can make sure people know that there's something really beautiful at the end of this.
How would you characterize the mental health and addiction services in Northumberland County?
In Northumberland County, I'm new here. I'm actually from Durham Region. I'm working out here. It's cool because I'm seeing a lot of action being taken, because I actually got to do two talks with the emergency part of Port Hope Hospital, sorry. And I got to sit and share my experience, strength, and hope, and where they might be falling short in the emergency department, you know, with people showing up. Because when the detoxes are full and emergency are just like seeing the same people over and over and over, you know, like, where do they go? So I was fortunate enough to get to sit and have meetings with everybody involved with that to maybe bring some change in the way they're dealing with that. Right. So I'm starting to see some awareness. I'm starting to see some change, and I see the effort of them wanting to. So that's a plus. But the one thing that, you know, that is always a concern is what can they put into motion in a in an amount of time that it's going to be effective?
I'd like to talk a little bit about your story. When and sure. where were you born?
I was born in Oshawa, Ontario.
When?
1975, March 18th.
What was your childhood like?
My childhood, it was, I was raised by addicts. And, you know, it, the apple doesn't fall far from the tree a lot of times. I was raised where everything was dealt with volume and violence. I'm the middle of 13 kids. And, you know, we grew up in basically a step up from poverty. First up was best dressed. And we, you know, it was a very abusive home. So
what were your teen years like?
My teen years is when I discovered, I was about 11 years old when I started dabbling in drugs and alcohol. And, you know, by the time I was 11 or 12 years old, I realized I could sing. So when I realized I had a voice, it wasn't long before I put a band together. And I felt like that was going to be my way out of my abusive home life. I was going to get to tour. I was going to get to party. I was going to get to do all the things I saw all my favorite rock stars doing. Right. And that was fun for a lot of years until it wasn't.
Do you still play music? Do you still involved in music?
I sure am. I'm actually signed with a label out in the United States. We, you know, we just put out a new album, our second album. And it's, you know, we're doing a lot of really great things musically. With that opportunity, it allowed me to they put out a documentary based on my story. It's a little 10-minute short film called Chad Valier Up From the Dark, in which it's me, you know, sharing a bit of my journey in as much as I can in 10 minutes and how I went from a child to recovery. And that acquired 26 Laurel recognitions. And in most cases, a lot of movies acquire six. So I thought that was pretty, you know, pretty great as for bringing awareness and being an advocate. And because of that, it led to me being able to put out a book in August, also called Chad Valier Up From the Dark, that's on Amazon, that's doing really well.
What was your life like as a young adult?
I was in addiction. I had a lot of mental health issues. I didn't know what mental health, good or bad, looked like, because I was surrounded my whole life in terrible mental health. So I seen dysfunction as very normal. I went about my life the way I saw life being, you know, being lived, and it wasn't good. You know, I thought, you know, I grew up around a lot of 1% bikers. So I was taught a code of the street very early on that wasn't, you know, productive for the rest of my life. I was not in a gang or a bike club or anything like that, but I associated with a lot of them. And so with that being said, you know, when you're, you know, when in Rome, you tend to live like the Romans, right? So my life as a young adult was basically trying to, you know, maintain a drug habit and live the life of a rock star while trying to raise kids and a family, which I was very terrible at for a very long time.
How bad did it get for you?
It got really bad to the point where suicide was an option. And it wasn't just a thought. It was very thought through and planned out. And it was that, you know, it was right around that point that I knew something had to change. And I ended up going to a treatment center. But I went to a treatment center the first time with all the wrong, I did it for all the wrong reasons, you know, I guess there's no real bad reason to go to rehab, but I wasn't going to get clean. Technically, I was going to learn how to use drugs successfully because I didn't like my life and I wanted everything back. I didn't have a relationship with my children anymore. I didn't have no relationship in my life had ever worked out to that point, really romantic or otherwise. And I was just a terrible friend. I was a terrible brother. I was a terrible son. I was a terrible father. You know, I just wasn't, a great person in any aspect of my life. And I kind of got sick and tired of being sick and tired.
So then what made you decide to change, to move towards recovery?
Like I said, I just found, you know, I found faith. I found a way to, you know, I just didn't want to, I didn't want to hurt people anymore, you know? And I mean, you can like, a lot of people think, you know, the drugs or the addict is only hurting themselves, but people forget that, you know, you're tied to lives around you. Right. So I didn't take into consideration how my mom was feeling or how my kids were feeling, because as a drug addict, I was very, you know, the nature of our disease is a selfish, self-centered, self-seeking behavior. You know, somebody once said to me, I didn't think much of myself, but I was all I thought about. Right. So, you know, and I that was very much like, how is this affecting me? How is this affecting me? And not taking into consideration anything around me.
Was there a seminal moment where something happened and things shifted for you?
100%. And I find this moment is very different for everybody. But I find for myself, I woke up one morning and I got on my knees and I just looked up to the sky and I said, if you just tell me what to do, I'll do whatever you tell me. And I felt this blanket of honey wrap around me. And it was like nothing I had ever felt. And I started laughing and crying hysterically. And I knew at that moment that my life had to change. And from that moment on, that was May 31st, 2021. And I've not looked back.
What were the steps in your recovery that you took to get where you are today?
Well, the first was admitting that I had a problem. And the problem with admitting that you have a problem is that once you admit that, then change has to happen. Right? So if you're not ready for change, you're probably not going to admit that you have a problem. So I went through the insanity cycle that many people with substance use disorders do, is we, you know, we go through, we keep thinking we're going to do this by ourselves and our, you know, we're going to do it this time and it's going to be different, you know, and everything, you know, and, you know, the definition of insanity is doing the same thing over and over, expecting a different result. And from the minute I would pick up a drink or a drug, it never ended different any time that I did that. The only thing that changed was how fast I hit a bottom. And, you know, my bottoms, and I hit many rock bottoms in the years I was addicted to drugs. And my, you know, every bottom looked a little bit different. So I didn't always recognize it as a bottom. Like, I think a lot of people tend to, if they're not homeless, doing the half fentanyl fold on the street, pushing a grocery cart, I think they disqualify themselves as having a problem. And we don't realize that what unmanageability is different for everybody. I mean, if you're calling in sick every Monday for work, I'm pretty sure that qualifies you. If you're losing relationships and you're coming home and the first thing you're doing is drinking until you're happy, you probably qualify. You know, it's what you've decided makes it unmanageable for you or the people around you.
Why is it important you share your personal story?
To show people that there's a way out. That's, you know, I feel in my heart that I took a lot from this world when I was in active addiction. And I did. I took a lot from the people I loved and I took a lot from this world. And my goal when I got clean was to give back as much as I took. And that is going to prove to be a very great feat, I promise.
I understand you're speaking at the Come Together Northumberland event. Can you give us a taste of what you're going to say?
I am going to share a lot of what I shared with you. I'm probably going to go a little bit deeper. I'm going to get very open because, you know, I'm also a survivor of sexual abuse. And I think a lot of that, you know, and not everybody that has a substance use disorder comes from that type of abuse, but many of us do, right? And the minute you become vocal about things like that, it's more apt to open a door for someone to go, hey, I don't have to be afraid. And that is so important to me, to make sure that people know they don't have to be afraid of things they were not in control of, right? So I'm gonna get as deep as I'm allowed to go without, getting too graphic, but I'm going to get very personal, and I'm going to make sure people know that, you know, there is a way out of this. And like I said before, there's something really beautiful at the end of it all.
Why do you feel it's necessary to go so deep?
Well, I guess if I showed up and went, yeah, I'm a drug addict and, you know, I'm better now, that doesn't leave a lot of room for anybody to identify with me, right? And I it took me so many years to be honest about the abuse that I endured throughout my life. And I felt those were shackles. And I felt that kept me locked in. There's a line in a book that I read in my recovery, and it says, secrets grow in the dark and they die in the light of exposure. And I think, you know, secrets keep us sick. And I think if we're in a place where we can't, you know, share with somebody and maybe open a door for someone to know they're not alone, I think that's dangerous. And I think it's my responsibility to make sure that if I can be a voice for someone and let them know they're not alone, then it's not really a job for me. It's my responsibility.
Have you followed the local efforts regarding people facing addictions and homelessness?
I'm recently just getting involved in the local part of it. I've always been involved with as much of it in my own city as I could be. As I said, well, you know, I'm out there, you know, I'm out there, you know, at night, and I'm the one dropping off packages. You know, I'm making sure that people are fed and that there's Narcan kits and all that stuff. But my goal this year is to become more active and more involved in trying to find a solution for that. So I'm exercising any avenue I can.
How would you assess the local efforts around addiction, mental health, and homelessness?
I get to work pretty closely with, some people that are right in the trenches through the organization I work for and the mother company of it. And, you know, there's a couple people that work in the organization that are hands-on in it. So I get to work really close to them to stay informed on what's been happening, right? So I'm getting closer to understanding what my role is and what I can do and how I can be involved in it more. So
what's the name of the organization and the company?
I work at the Youth Wellness Hub in Northumberland, and we are a subsidiary of Rebound. Rebound's our mother company.
Do you think there are sufficient services in Northumberland?
I don't think there's sufficient services anywhere. I think there can always be more. I think there's more people that need help than we can accommodate. And I think that I don't think there's ever going to be enough because addiction is not going anywhere.
So what's missing then?
The resources. There's just not enough. Like, I don't know. Like, I would love to answer that. But I think a lot of attention is being put in a lot of the wrong areas, you know, and we could get into that. That's a whole other podcast,
example,
right?
Let's do that. For example.
Well, I don't know if I want to get into it just because it can probably get me in trouble. So I'm going to say that I think addiction and homelessness tends to take a back burner to many other issues. And I think, we need to start focusing on, you know, why we can't get people housed, why we can't fix the economy to a point where rent is not $2,000 a month. You know, people with full-time jobs these days cannot afford a one-bedroom apartment. They have to have roommates or they have to be in relationships. And so I think the economy is a big part of it. I think, you know, the government's failing in a lot of areas.
What's being done well locally?
I think places like this hub that I work at, I think, you know, allowing a place for people to come and identify. I think it is imperative for a place like this to, I think it is imperative for a place like this for young people to be able to just drop in and have somewhere safe to come. I think, you know, like our staff here, it's a bunch of people that all come from different walks of life, so we can adapt to the youth that come in. I think, you know, places like Rebound, I think places, you know, that allow people to come in, places where you can go and, you know, come and do a resume if you need to. I think, you know, with Rebound, when they, you know, they have a worker there that goes out to the 10 cities and connect with them. And I think there's a lot of things being done right, but I think there's more not being done right.
What do you think about the provincial government's efforts to get rid of safe injection sites and replace them with the homelessness and addiction recovery treatment hubs?
From a personal standpoint, I believe abstinence is a much better road, right? But again, I'm not against harm reduction, and I want that very clear. So when I think of safe injection sites, you know, when I was in active addiction, I don't know that I cared where I left my paraphernalia when I was done with it, if I had to hide somewhere and do it. So having a place where I could go, have the drugs tested to make sure I didn't die, you know, to make sure there was nothing in it that would kill me, to have it cleaned up after I was done, to know there was doctors and counselors there 24/7, you know, there's absolutely nothing wrong with that. You know, I think that's great. But in another perspective, you know, are we winning when somebody is overdosing on the floor? Right. So it's like, you know, it's, you know, for me, I'm an abstinence-based guy, so I can understand why they are changing that. And it makes sense to me, because at the end of the day, we want people off of drugs. You know, harm reduction, like I said, when it comes to things like that, it's always great if there's a plan. But the problem is I don't always think there's a plan in motion, because when you sign up for programs like that, it's not often that, you know, they're trying to get you off of the methadone or the Suboxone or those things. It's like you have to ask to be off of it, right? And I think that's where it's really failing, is because they're not getting people into these programs to get them off of it.
If you could sit down at the kitchen table with some of those in Northumberland who are most concerned about addictions and addicts, what message would you say to them to help them make good decisions for their community?
These people are not degenerates. They are not lost. I mean, they're lost, but they're not lost forever. You know, these people, I mean, you're only seeing the shell of them. You know, we need to get these people healthy so we can get them active in society. We need to, you know, we need to feed them. We need to provide more programs. We need to give them somewhere to go. Like, the detoxes are full everywhere. You know, we got to provide spaces for them to get help. And we don't have enough.
Chad Valier, I want to thank you so much for talking to me today.
Yes, sir. Thank you for having me.
That is Chad Valier, a peer support worker and recovery advocate who works in Northumberland. I want to thank my guests this week for talking to me, and I want to thank all the listeners for tuning in today. Please join me again next week when we will talk to the people on the front lines and those behind the scenes who make a difference in your life and Northumberland County. So please tune in. If you would like to listen or share this or any podcast, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. There you will find past podcasts, news, and other information about life and politics in Northumberland County. Or you can go to the radio station's website at northumberland897.ca. I'm Robert Washburn. Thanks for taking time out of your day to listen in, and I hope over the week you will continue to consider this. Thank you for listening to this podcast from Consider This. If you have any comments or would like to suggest a story, please contact me at considerthisnorthumberland@gmail.com, or you can message me on Facebook at Consider This. If you enjoyed this podcast or are looking for more news and information about Northumberland County, please check out my website at consider-this.ca. That's consider-this.ca. And don't forget to share. And again, thank you for listening, and stay tuned for more from Consider This.